Chapter 7. There is no out there, out there. Dr. Karl Priebram has had a long and illustrious career. Born in Austria in 1919, Priebram is both a neurosurgeon and a neurophysiologist who spent many years trying to find out where memories are stored in the brain. The problem was that in the 1920s, a brain scientist by the name of Carl Lashley had found that no matter what portion of a rat's brain he removed, he was unable to eradicate its memory of how to perform complex tasks it had learned prior to surgery. So Priebram set out to solve the mystery of memory storage that seemed independent of brain cells, called neurons. But it wasn't until Priebram met David Bohm, one of the pioneers in quantum physics, that he found his answer. The Wikipedia says that Bohm helped establish the foundation for Priebram's theory that the brain operates in a manner similar to a hologram, in accordance with quantum mathematical principles and the characteristics of wave patterns. End of quote. Technically, according to Michael Talbot, Priebram believes memories are encoded not in neurons or small groupings of neurons, but in patterns of nerve impulses that crisscross the entire brain in the same way that patterns of laser light interference crisscross the entire area of a piece of film containing a holographic image. In other words, Priebram believes the brain is itself a hologram. End of quote. Memory storage is not the only thing that becomes more understandable in light of Priebram's theory. As Michael Talbot explains, another is how the brain is able to translate the avalanche of frequencies it receives via the senses, light frequencies, sound frequencies, etc., into the concrete world of our perceptions. Encoding and decoding frequencies is precisely what a hologram does best. Just as a hologram functions as a sort of lens, a translating device able to convert an apparently meaningless blur of frequencies into a coherent image, Priebram believes the brain also comprises a lens and uses holographic principles to mathematically convert the frequencies it receives through the senses into the inner world of our perceptions. In short, Priebram believes our brains mathematically construct hard reality by relying on input from a frequency domain. End of quote. Okay, let's translate all of this into simple English. According to Carl Priebram and the results of many scientific experiments, the human brain itself is a hologram. Its function is to receive holographic wave frequencies and translate them into the physical universe we see out there. And now the fun begins. I want to talk about two specific scientific experiments, out of many, that not only seem to prove Priebram's theory, but go beyond it to an amazing conclusion. The first began in the 1970s with a researcher in the physiology department of the University of California, San Francisco, Dr. Benjamin Libet. Put very simply, Libet would experiment with brain surgery patients during their operations. The patients' brains were exposed and they were fully conscious, having received only local anesthetic. Libet would, for example, stimulate the patient's little finger on one hand, like a pinprick, and ask the patients to tell him when they felt it. Then he would stimulate the area of the brain associated with that little finger, and ask the patients to tell him when they felt that as well. Before I tell you what he discovered, we need to understand how we feel things, like a pinprick. The stimulus, or pinprick, is transmitted from the location on the body where it happened to the brain, and then the brain lets us know about the sensation. Technically, we don't actually feel things where they happen. We feel them in the brain. So it would make sense that if you stimulate someone's little finger, it would take time, maybe fractions of a second, for the nerves to move that sensation to the brain where it would be felt. Since the physical body is limited by space and time, and nothing in the physical universe, at least according to Einstein, can travel faster than the speed of light. Basically, it would take time for a stimulus on the little finger to get to the brain and for the person to then become aware of it. On the other hand, it would also make sense that if you stimulated the brain directly at the exact location where the little finger sends the sensation to be felt, the person would be aware of it immediately. In other words, there would be no time delay since the brain already has the information about the stimulus and only needs to alert the person to the sensation. What Libet found, and others after him, was that the exact opposite was true. In fact, you will probably hear many times in this book that the information we're getting from the scientific research in quantum physics is proving that the opposite of a lot of what we have always believed is true. Libet's patients would tell him instantly, with no time delay, when he stimulated their little finger. And yet there was a delay when he stimulated the brain directly. Listen as Dr. Stuart Hameroff describes these experiments by Dr. Libet from What the Bleep Down the Rabbit Hole.
In the late 1970s, a neurophysiologist at University of California, San Francisco, named Ben Libet, did some very famous experiments. What Libet did was study patients who were having neurosurgery on their brains, with their brains exposed, while they were awake. They were given a local anesthetic to numb the area of the skull and scalp to access their brains, and they were awake, and Ben would talk to these people. So, for example, what he did was he would stimulate their little finger and look at the part of the sensory cortex on the opposite side that was related to that, record from it electrically, and ask the patient when he or she felt the stimulus on the little finger. And he would also stimulate at that particular area of cortex. Now, what you would think would be that if you stimulate the little finger, it takes a finite period of time to get to the opposite side of the cortex, so the patient would report it a fraction of a second later after the stimulus. And when you stimulate it directly, the patient would report it immediately. He found just the opposite. When he stimulated the little finger, the patient felt it immediately, and when he stimulated directly in the cortex, there was a delay.
Libet was flabbergasted. He tried to find an explanation, as did many other scientists, and the prevailing theory became that time can travel backwards. It's called the time reversal theory, or subjective backward referral, or antedating. However, after trying to prove this and failing, Libet himself later said, "There appeared to be no neural mechanism that could be viewed as directly mediating or accounting for the subjective sensory referrals backward in time." End of quote. In other words, there is no evidence in the brain for time reversal as the explanation for this phenomenon. For now, just file that information away. And let's talk about another experiment. This one started in the 1990s, conducted by Dr. Dean Radin and other colleagues. Dean Radin is a senior scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, on the adjunct faculty at Sonoma State University, and part of the distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook Graduate School and Research Center. He earned an undergraduate degree in electrical engineering from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and both a master's degree in electrical engineering and a doctorate in educational psychology from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He worked at AT&T Bell Labs and GTE Labs, mainly on human factors of advanced telecommunications products and services, and then held appointments at Princeton University, Edinburgh University, University of Nevada, Las Vegas, SRI International, Interval Research Corporation, and the Boundary Institute. I say all that because Radin's research is admittedly not widely accepted by the mainstream scientific community, which is why you may have never heard of it, although his credentials are beyond question. Here's why his results are so hard for some scientists to swallow. Radin would hook a person up to various machines to measure a number of different bodily responses, such as heart rate, EKG, skin conductance, the amount of blood in the fingertip, and respiration. The person then sits in front of a computer screen with a button in their hand. They're told to press the button whenever they're ready, and 5 seconds later the computer will randomly select a picture and display it on the screen. There are two different types of pictures the computer can choose from. One group of pictures will evoke an emotional response in normal people, like a picture of violence, or war, or rape, or ugliness, or the Twin Towers coming down on 9/11. The other group of pictures is designed to be neutral, to normally not have any emotional impact when viewed, like a scene of a city street in any town, USA. We already know what happens in the body when people see an emotional image, what happens to their heart rate, to their EKG, skin conductance, the amount of blood in the fingertip, and respiration. They all spike. We also know what happens in the body when people see a neutral or non-emotional image. They remain calm. When the person in this experiment pushes the button, the computer has not yet chosen which picture to display or from which group, and will not make that decision until 5 seconds later when it immediately puts the picture on the screen. Now, here's the amazing thing. The person's bodily responses being measured would occur before the computer chose the picture and displayed it on the screen. In other words, the person's heart rate, EKG, skin conductance, the amount of blood in the fingertip, and respiration would all spike prior to the picture coming up if the picture were going to be an emotional picture, and the bodily responses would all remain calm if the picture about to appear would be neutral. To repeat, all of these bodily responses, or lack of bodily responses, would occur before the computer had even chosen which picture to put on the screen. The only conclusion that makes any sense is that the brain knows what picture is coming before the person is aware of it. Indeed, before the computer has even chosen which picture to display, and the body is responding accordingly. Listen to Dr. Radin explain this experiment himself from What the Bleep Down the Rabbit Hole.
So the experiment that I developed to look at this is we wire you up typically to look at skin conductance but also heart rate and other parameters. You will sit in front of a computer screen and you press a button and you know that 5 seconds later you're going to see a picture. It could be a very calm picture or it might be a very emotional picture. And it's randomly selected by the computer immediately before it's shown. So when you press the button, the future is not yet determined. So you need real precognition in order to be able to jump into the future and get it somehow. So since we're looking at your physiology, we know what happens to physiology after you see an emotional image. And we know what happens after you see a calm image. The question is, does that future experience leak into your present? Does it happen before you see the picture? And through this experiment, you can see what happens. Electrical activity of the heart, EKG. This is photoplethysmograph, which is the amount of blood in the fingertip, and respiration, breathing in, breathing out. Press the button. Well, what happens to physiology? Well, if it starts rising before the image appears, it may suggest that you're about to get an emotional picture. And if it stays calm, it suggests maybe you're going to get a calm picture. So we've done this kind of experiment for several hundred people, and colleagues have run this experiment as well. And as it turns out, that is exactly what you see. People become aroused before randomly selected pictures in the future that happen to be emotional, and they remain calm before randomly selected pictures that are calm.
Dr. Andrew Newberg, director of the Center for Spirituality and the Neurosciences at the University of Pennsylvania, adds that
there have been some studies which have shown that when people are beginning to move a hand or beginning to say something, that there's actually activity in the brain and certain nerve cells of the brain, even before they become consciously aware of what they're trying to do.
And the very latest evidence, in July of 2010, comes from a BBC documentary called Neuroscience and Free Will. Here's the setup. The subject lies in a CT scanner holding a button in each hand. All the subject has to do is decide to press the button in his left hand or the button in his right hand, and then press the appropriate button immediately while the CT scanner records his brain activity. The result is that the brain clearly shows up to 6 seconds in advance which button the person will press, left or right. This is 6 seconds before the subject consciously decides which button he will press. The brain activity is so clear and 100% consistent that the technician watching the scanner could easily predict with absolute certainty which button the subject would press before the subject makes his own conscious decision. You really need to watch the video on YouTube to believe it. What does all this mean? Before I answer that question, I have to introduce one last scientific concept called Occam's razor, a principle that's been hanging around for almost 700 years. It is often paraphrased as, all other things being equal, the simplest solution is the best, although that's technically not the correct interpretation of Occam's razor. It is also called the scientific principle of parsimony, which is a preference for the least complex explanation for an observation. The general rule is that the best answer requires the least number of assumptions and postulates the fewest entities. There have been many different attempts to explain the results of these brain experiments by as many different scientists, but the simplest and most logical explanation, the one that seems to satisfy Occam's razor the best, is that the brain knows what is going to happen before it happens out there in the physical universe. The sequence, apparently, is that the brain receives holographic wave information and then sends it out there, creating a physical universe for the person to perceive and experience. For example, in the Libet experiments, the brain knew the little finger was going to be stimulated before the actual stimulation took place, and therefore there was no time delay for the person to become aware of it. However, when the brain was stimulated directly, as if a new hologram was being downloaded to it, it took time for the brain to send the sensation out to the little finger and bring it back to the brain to be perceived. In Radin's experiments, the only thing that makes sense is that the brain knew what picture would appear because it was creating the reality that was about to happen, not simply responding to a reality after it happened. Let me repeat that, because it is so critical to understanding how the holographic universe works. The brain knew what picture would appear because it was creating the reality that was about to happen, not simply responding to a reality after it happened. So, let's put this together with Prebram's holographic brain model. Prebram says the human brain is itself a hologram, and it will mathematically construct hard reality by relying on input from a frequency domain. Remember the field? The field is Prebram's frequency domain, an infinite number of possibilities existing as waves of frequencies. So Prebram is saying the brain receives wave frequencies from the field, which it then translates into hard reality, what we normally call the physical universe. In fact, all these experiments suggest your brain receives a hologram in wave frequencies from the field, collapses the wave function and converts them into particles to create physical reality, and then sends that reality out there for you to experience. This is confirmed by the CT scan experiments in the BBC documentary Neuroscience and Free Will. In fact, if you watch the video, you can even see the exact area of the brain where it is converting the downloaded wave frequencies into the hologram that 6 seconds later will be projected out there for you to become aware of and experience. It means, first of all, the human brain is the observer that collapses the wave function that I talked about in Chapter 5, since quantum physics says it is the observer that changes an electron from a wave into a particle. It also means our senses, seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, are not really sensing some independent reality out there, but in fact are projecting that reality so it appears to be out there. In addition to being receivers, then, our eyes are projectors, since your brain knows what you are about to experience before you perceive it with your senses. Apparently, once our brain converts the wave frequencies from the field, it projects them out there and makes it appear that we are surrounded by a total immersion movie. Then, and only then, our senses read what has been projected out there and bring that information back to the brain. I don't think anyone knows exactly how this works right now, but I feel confident, as the research in quantum physics continues, someone will discover the process. Meanwhile, we have been given a big clue, one of those hints I talked about in the last chapter, in the form of the modern computer. Most computers currently use what is called binary code, which is made up of nothing but zeros and ones. If you look at the zeros and ones themselves, they look random and chaotic. But inside every computer is a CPU, a central processing unit, that acts as the brain of the computer. This CPU receives the binary code in sequences of zeros and ones, translates that binary code, and projects the results onto a computer screen where we can see it in a form that makes sense to us. A computer also has its own sensory perceptions, which include things like a mouse, a touch screen, a microphone, a video camera, and so on. When we interact with the computer through one of its senses, like clicking the mouse, that message gets sent back to the CPU for further processing. Therefore, in the same way a computer's CPU receives its binary code, translates it, projects the results onto a screen, and then processes the inputs that come back through the mouse and other sensory perceptions, our human brain receives wave frequencies from the field, translates them into particles by collapsing the wave function, projects the results out there, and then processes the inputs that come back through our own sensory perceptions. I invite you to try an experiment yourself. Go outside, or just look around wherever you are, and imagine for a moment you are not looking at some independent or objective reality out there, but that you are projecting that reality out there, much in the same way a projector puts a movie onto the theater screen. If the holographic brain model is taken to its logical conclusions, says Michael Talbot in the Holographic Universe, it opens the door on the possibility that objective reality, the world of coffee cups, mountain vistas, elm trees, and table lamps, might not even exist. Is it possible that what is out there is really a vast resonating symphony of waveforms, a frequency domain that is transformed into the world as we know it only after it enters our brain? If the concreteness of the world is but a secondary reality, and what is out there is actually a holographic blur of frequencies, and if the brain is also a hologram and only processes some of the frequencies out of this blur, what becomes of objective reality? Put quite simply, it ceases to exist. Although we may think we are physical beings moving through a physical world, this is an illusion. We are really receivers floating through a kaleidoscopic sea of frequency. End of quote. And David Bohm said, "The tangible reality of our everyday lives is really a kind of illusion, like a holographic image. Underlying it is a deeper order of existence, a vast and more primary level of reality that gives birth to all the objects and appearances of our physical world in much the same way that a piece of holographic film gives birth to a hologram." End of quote. In other words, as Fred Alan Wolf and Lynn McTaggart both say,
there is no out there, independent of what's going on in here.
Reality is unset jello. That's the way I like to put it. It is this just big indeterminate sledge out there that's our potential life. And there's and that we, by our very act of involvement, our act of noticing, our observation, we get that jello to set. We're intrinsic to the whole process of reality. Our involvement creates that reality. And so we have this involvement in everything. We are our world. There's no out there, out there.
What is out there, says Michael Talbot, is a vast ocean of waves and frequencies, and reality looks concrete to us only because our brains are able to take this holographic blur and convert it into the sticks and stones and other familiar objects that make up our world. End of quote. What is real? How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, what you can taste and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain, said Morpheus in The Matrix. Time to sum all of this up in a nice, neat little paragraph. What we have always thought of as our life, our reality, is not real, according to quantum physics, but actually a holographic 3D movie we have been immersed in, whose wave frequencies have been downloaded from the field to our brain, where they are translated into particles located in space and time, and projected out there for us to perceive through our senses. What this means is that there is no independent, objective reality out there, but a wholly subjective reality created totally dependent on what's in here. In short, there is no out there, out there. According to Michael Talbot, there is evidence to suggest that our world and everything in it, from snowflakes to maple trees to falling stars and spinning electrons, are only ghostly images, projections from a level of reality so beyond our own that it is literally beyond both space and time. End of quote. Even Einstein is reported to have said, "Reality is merely an illusion, albeit a very persistent one." Listen again to Dr. Amit Goswami.
This is the only radical thinking that you need to do. But it is so radical, it's so difficult, because our tendency is that the world is already out there, independent of my experience. It is not. Quantum physics has been so clear about it.
I highly recommend you watch the movie called The 13th Floor, starring Craig Bierko, produced in 1999.